We're always done. Yeah, I don't like that.
House Committee on Revenue for February 22nd, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to go out of order today because we're not all here yet. And I'm going to reopen the public hearing from yesterday on House Bill 2203. Paul, just give us the briefest reminder of what this bill is about. Change the distribution of money collected by the department on marijuana.
Right. Okay. Mr. Chair, it changes the distribution. You're discussing yesterday. We also had put together a preliminary -1 amendment for the committee to look at to address some issues. And your direction was for us to work with the counties and cities in particular to refine that amendment.
Right. And I would simply, well, let's hear the testimony, and then I have a little comment to make about the bill in general. Alex Kyler and Wendy Johnson, is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill? We got a bunch of business today, so we're going to fly right along. 2203.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here today on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. You heard this bill yesterday. House Bill 2203 looks at the distribution of the state share of marijuana taxes, and we have a few concerns with the bill and would like some tweaking and are suggesting a work group might be appropriate. First off, the present law is 10% share goes to cities. This bill would change it to 30, and Rob Babette explained how the budget has changed, and so we understand that. Of course, anything more than 10% to cities would be great, but we're not expecting that at this juncture. But on page 1 of the bill, line 20, it says that our share, the city's share, is to assist local law enforcement. So that sort of reads like a purpose statement that sometimes statutes have. But it could also be read as you have to segregate your money from the state and keep a separate fund and make sure it's for local law enforcement. And that's just a local budgeting nightmare to have to keep all these different funds and track how it's being spent. And so we would like that clarified. The bill right now deletes it when it rewrites the distribution, but we all know that cities and counties, one of their primary functions is law enforcement, and so to have to keep this separate and make sure it's used for that is just a pain. And so we would prefer, like our other state shared revenues, that it be flexible. So that's our first issue, besides the share itself. The next one is the distribution formula itself, and this is where there's a policy question that gets complicated. Present law is that it's supposed to be per capita for the city share. That's how most of our state shared revenues go. And so if it was done that way, we'd take the total that goes to cities and take it divided by the population, and we'd figure out the per person, and then it would go to cities that way. The -1 amendments would accomplish that for the year that's already been collected that we still haven't been paid for, plus all the way up until July. And that's what our cities had been expecting and budgeting for, was that per capita share, because that had been the law. But because there's that liquor loan, the state isn't releasing the money yet to us. And so the technical way the law is written, it says if distributions are made after July, it uses another formula. So even though they were collected before July, there's that whole complication. So we prefer to keep it per capita for what, and base it based on when it was collected, not when it's distributed, because that's sort of arbitrary. Because right now, in effect, there is no per capita because the plan is not to distribute it after July. But then there are two other formulas. The existing law would have a switch to...
So are you involved in the work group that's going to be working on this?
We hope so. That's what we're sort of pointing out. There's three formulas floating around, and we need to figure it out.
Okay.
Chair. The second one that's in the bill...
I mean, it may be useful to spend a lot of time describing it, but if the work group's going to work on that, maybe we could save it for the amendment.
Mr. Chair, that would be fine. I just wanted to tell you kind of where we're at and explain why we need to have a work group. The existing law says 50% based on retail licenses and then 50% based on the other three licenses. And the bill would switch to 25% based on canopies and 75% based on retail licenses. And these formulas are all, you know, you can make them work, but the board of directors for the league has actually voted on this and said, this license thing, as you heard yesterday, we have a whole backlog of licenses. Licenses keep changing. It doesn't really reflect whether a business has a lot of business or there's just sheer numbers. We just don't like the license thing a whole lot and prefer per capita. It's something we'd like to discuss in a work group. And the distinction between retail licenses versus producer licenses versus wholesale licenses, or it gets complicated on who's going to be the winner and the loser on this formula.
You.
So we just would prefer to discuss it. It also
And if you can come up with a solution that sounds reasonable and is sensible and can be properly calculated, I suspect the committee would welcome that approach. I don't see anybody arguing with me.
Great.
Okay.
Great. And it also looks at the preceding year, and we think that's just a poor decision because they literally change every month.
Thank you.
And then next is the how much, when we're paid. It sounds like you have a plan to deal with that with the Dash 1 amendments. We would be supportive of that because we haven't received anything to date. And then how it's being paid. It sounds like the plan is to use the Department of Administrative Services through the Liquor Fund, but that's not actually in statute anywhere. It's sort of an agreement, and so we're not sure if that's necessary or not, but we want to know if we're still not being paid, where do we go? That would be nice to have it clear. And then lastly, when the Department of Revenue presented, there was mention of the local tax and how that's working. Most of our cities did sign an agreement with the Department of Revenue to have the state collect the local tax. So there's the payment that happens every month, and then there's a filing that happens every quarter. And so with the payment and filing, those cities, and there's counties as well that have signed up to have DOR do that administration, the retailers would be putting that line for their local tax in the same form on their filing, and they'll be making the same payments. And then the Department of Revenue will be handling that through DAST to get those payments done. By our count, we have less than 20 cities that are doing that on our own, and the legislature provided that authority for DOR to do the collection. The Department of Revenue does collect. There's a charge for that administration, but we think that's the right public safety way to go. We haven't received any payments yet because a quarter hasn't happened.
Right. Yes.
So we'll report back if there's any issues, but we're thinking this should work well for the state. And that concludes my comments on 2203.
Mr. Kyler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I did submit written testimony to OLIS yesterday. I was not aware of the Dash 1 amendment at the time. Mr. Chair, the focus of our concern has been the change up in or the lack of payment to counties to date and this formula that was sort of a first-year formula versus second-year formula. In the Dash 1s, that looks like it's taken care of, and so we're very much appreciative of the committee flagging that issue and attempting a fix for it. The other question we had was with respect to the various formulas and are there winners and losers to those formulas? Sounds to me like there will be some work to further explore that, and so we're supportive of that. Finally, one of the concerns that we've had all along is that when you look at the allocations of the tax, there's money to the Oregon State Police and there's money to local law enforcement agencies. The state police money is really unrestricted, as it should be. The local law enforcement money, though, is for purposes of the statute, and that's become very narrow. So the sheriff, for example, in our county has been unable or would be unable to utilize any of those tax revenues for things like driving under the influence. And we think that statutory limitation really does need to be eliminated to give our public safety agencies just as much discretion as possible in how to use those dollars.
Thank you.
We look forward to work with Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you so much. I simply want to note that I'm not in favor of moving any bill that significantly changes the allocation to the public school system. It is clear, I think, from legislative history that the insertion of the Common School Fund was an error. The proponents of the initiative intended that the money be used for operating expenses, which meant it should have gone to the state school fund. But I will tell you that there are times when the legislature ought to second-guess the voters on things like this. I don't think this is one of those times. And so the point of the bill originally, I think, was to change the allocation, significantly change the allocation of the funds. I just want to make sure everyone's aware that, that I'm not in favor of that, and I'm perfectly happy to have the work group consider changes in the technical issues having to do with the way it's distributed, with the methods, the issues that that you raised a bit ago. But I'm frankly not very interested in moving a bill that would have the effect of changing in any significant way the distribution to the various components of the government that it was intended for in the original initiative, just so you know. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2203.
Senator Brzezinski.
Oh, is he here on that one? On 2203?
And 2203.
I'm sorry. We'll reopen 2203, and we'll open 2204. Senator Brzezinski, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to get in and give a little testimony at this point with the other assignments that we all have. I've asked, let me, first, as Floyd Brzezinski, State Senator District 4, represents parts of Lane and Douglas counties. It came to my attention, I knew that there had been some work in looking at potentially the recalculation of the formula on the distribution of tax from the cannabis taxes that we're collecting as a state, as well as potentially looking at increasing the percentage that would be going to the locals. What I'm going to ask each of you to please take in consideration is the goals and purposes of why we have going, why we're going down the route that we have been with the goal from my perspective is to basically do away with as best we can the black market in this industry. We're seeing an industry that has very renowned reputation internationally as to the product that comes out of the state. We're now seeing an opportunity to do a transition and making that where it will in fact be one that we can actually break down the black market that has been penetrated this area for decades. And I'm very, very concerned with the situations that I, when I read the bills and understand there's a dash one now for House Bill 2203, also understand this may be just what as some would say is a starting point as to there will be more work. When you look in the historical perspective, when Measure 91 was presented to the voters, please look at what was called out in the measure as to what the purpose of the measure was and what it actually intended for the distribution of money. I will tell you that in the joint committee on marijuana, that we have in fact looked at some of these issues during the last two sessions, and an attempt to honor what was in the voters. Initiative that was passed by them in 2014. And I will tell you that many of the individuals, when you looked at 2203 and the original, what their current language is as to the percentage that was supposed to be going to the different perspectives, such as 40% to the Common School Fund, the 20% to the mental health, alcoholism, and drug services account, 15% to the state police. And then there's the two 10%, one to the city and one to the counties. Now, what I'm going to ask you to also take in consideration is this, is that what the proposal now would actually increase the amount of that would be going to the cities and counties by 20%, going from 10% to 30%. So that is an increase for each of those is 20%. I will tell you that I just feel that we're going way too quickly in trying to up these amounts. Clearly, I would challenge those who will be speaking as to why they need to do it when we know the return right now on the tax return has and one estimate was sixfold of what it was originally anticipated to be bringing in. And you have the good Dr. Warner there to correct me, but my understanding is that the return for the first year was about $60 million, and with the first month of this year, meaning January, another $5-something million. So we're close to $66 million based on round numbers. And where you have the original coming in, one of the estimates was only $6 million. I think when we were sitting here and talking as a as the joint committee, we were hearing that they did not think that the money that they anticipated from what was actually the first calculations was going to be sufficient enough to take care of the needs of the locals. I would submit to you that if you're getting sixfold over what you anticipated, we should be taking that in consideration. I'm not saying we shouldn't be revisiting this and relooking at this. I'm just saying the timing is not correct for now. I will share with you, many of you know this story, some of you don't. My sister was murdered 44 years ago. The person that took her life because he was involved in the drug business, and he also had other plans for her, was basically wanting to string her out and pimp her and had her in a domestic relation type of situation. I tell you that because those are the type of things that have, given me the fortitude to move forward and trying to bust the black market. And so to me, I want us as a legislature to actually look at what can we do to ensure that we have people coming into the regulated market and that the individuals that are wanting to participate in that market are going to use the legal means to get the product they want. Now, I've also, and I'm not sure how many of you have received these same type of phone calls, but I've heard from numerous constituents that because of what has happened in the last year with the transition of trying to get everything up on running, the push points, inability to have enough regulated labs, et cetera, that we're seeing prices going through the ceiling. I understand edibles are now twice as much as what they were when we first started this process. So you have other factors that are pushing for people to be looking for where can I get my deal. That brings us back to the black market. So I'm hoping that you as a committee will also have the same desires that I and others have expressed through our committee work, and that is to do it the most we can to impact the black market and making this a legitimate market. There will be plenty of time to be looking at what and how we should adjust those formulas to ensure that we are taking care of the business that we need to be taking care of, that the locals do in fact have the ability to do their perspective as to treatment, enforcement, and other regulatory functions. But I will just throw out on the table, if we have projections that started at $6 million in a biennium, and we are now seeing $66 million in the first year plus a month, it seems to me that you're already going to have an influx of additional money coming in to the locals, that type of adjustment doesn't need to be done. Now, the Dash Ones appears that whoever was putting that together was looking at trying to honor what the voters passed. The voters passed with the anticipation that 40% of that money was going to go into the Common School Fund. Now, this is above my pay grade, but what I understand is on the Common School Fund, only the interest can actually be used, not the quote unquote the principal. And I can understand why the Dash Ones could be coming forward to try to redirect the money that's allocated or is directed under the measure to other portions of education where it can be a direct infusion into, let's say, the classrooms at the district level. And I think that's very, astute for you to be looking at as to, how much we want to vary. I will put on the record that when I was asked about did I have a big heartburn about changing that component in the joint committee, I said I did not because I understood what they're attempting to do. But when you look at 2203 and you look at how it's being proposed that we're going to have the significant increase of an additional 20% to the locals, then when you take in conjunction with House Bill 2204, I think you see another situation of where you would actually, if both these passed as they are currently written, they would, meaning the counties and the cities, would be much, 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 much more flush than they ever anticipated to be at this stage of the game. So on the 2204, we entered into this perspective, and everyone in that committee was saying we want to do what we can to adversely impact the black market. So where we currently have a percentage of 3% for going into the cities and 3% potentially going to the counties for their share on the price of items sold within their jurisdiction, to move it from 3% to 8%, that's an additional 5%. And I would ask you to ask those who are coming in after me to show why they need to have these type of adjustments at this stage. And I would also say that while we're trying to get this industry under control in the sense of building it up and having it being viable, that we should do everything we can to assist that industry by trying to curtail the black market. And both of these bills, based on what is currently being proposed, will in fact enhance the black market because you're putting much of a cost driver for the legitimate business, and you will in fact, and I've heard from others that they're seeing people diverting out of the legal retail operations and are in fact going, let's say, back to, or in fact, in some cases, we may have already enhanced those who may not have been participating in that market to go to that market because of the price is controlling. So those are a few comments I have. I'm more than willing to try to answer any questions you may have, and I really do appreciate the chair and all of you on the committee giving me the opportunity to let me say my piece as to what I think is important. And again, I think this is an industry that, as far as I'm concerned, is here to stay. It's one that we should be welcoming. We need to make it as legitimate as quickly as we can, and we need to do everything we can to shut down the black market, and I believe the concepts in these two bills will have just the opposite effect.
Thank you very much. Questions for Senator Brzozinski? Representative Benson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, are there market studies? We were talking about this yesterday, actually, and the question was, how would we know the impact of these kinds of increases on where people purchase cannabis? Is this such a new industry that we don't have that kind of information? Are we just stuck guessing, or is there a better source of information about the impact this kind of activity would have, other than your good background as a prosecutor? What do we have?
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, as far as I know, there are no studies that are viable right now. This is anecdotal from what has happened in other states. Colorado and Washington State is the information I have received some direction to, as well as what I've heard from people in the industry here in Oregon. What we know is that when we started this track, we were the state that had the lowest revenue impact and the sense of taxes between those other two states. Now, the state of Alaska has a different formula of what they're doing, and I don't have the ability to look at how they're taxing versus what our taxes are and what that percentage would be. But I would submit from just a academic perspective that if you have the price on the legitimate market higher than what can be done through the black market, you will in fact see the cost drivers of people going for the undercut part. I wish, only time will tell, and I think we will, as we continue down this adventure in another year, we'll have 2 years, and at some point Dr. Warner will be able to say, I now have enough data to actually do some detail. I wish we had that, but I would just say from the gut reaction, I think most of us understand that if you have a product that is in demand, and if you can buy it cheaper than you can one place, you're going to, except for potentially convenience, you're probably going to find yourself going there. And the last part to that, I think, is what has happened with our attempt to bring in new licensed facilities to do the extracts, doing the edibles. Because of the bottleneck that we've had, people who have relied on those forms of medicine or recreational use are basically going to where they can get it. And right now, the easiest place to get it is in the black market because we just don't have the supply forces there yet.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Senator. I really appreciate your testimony. I will note before you leave that the thing that struck me most about the testimony we got yesterday from the Sheriff of Josephine County, from OLCC, is that there doesn't appear to be any concerted push, effort, or maybe a responsibility to actually deal directly with black market issues. The sheriff made the point that there, and in fact, so did the county commissioner who came from there, made the point that that there are a lot of out-of-state, there's a lot of out-of-state money coming to that area, probably for the purpose of preparing the drug for export, which of course is a violation of the federal rules that we're trying to follow, as you know. And I was struck by the apparent, by the fact that it doesn't seem to be anybody's responsibility to actually go after that in a direct way. I really understand and appreciate your testimony about the indirect issues that are involved in it. But we should be doing more to make sure that people who are preparing drugs for export are actually arrested and prosecuted for that. I don't know how to do that. Somebody involved in the Judiciary Committee might be able to pursue that.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, in response, clearly it's against the law. There are measures to be able to be taken. OLCC is the regulatory branch that has the enforcement. Clearly, when you're trying to start something from ground zero, I think if we actually look back to the days of Prohibition and when alcohol came back into the mainstream, many of the learning curves and growth issues for that industry could probably mirror what we're going through now. But I would still come back to the point that, I'll just say that I lost that battle regarding residency, even though we had a legal opinion that said that we could have, in fact, done that.
Yeah.
So now we're kind of dealt, another set of cards that we have to now deal with. But I would still submit that by keeping the price down for the legal market is going to be one of the drivers that's going to impact that. And clearly, if there are in those counties where there are less resources, I would submit that we should be trying to assist them through other means of law enforcement, state police, and then we should be helping OLCC as they go through their endeavor of getting the various businesses up and running, that their enforcement arm is also working simultaneously.
Thank you. Well, I raised the issue with Representative Barker this morning, and I've raised it with you now. And it's clear that we're on the same page when it comes to that issue, at least. I appreciate the work that you did on the joint, what did you call it, the joint committee?
That's, the joint committee.
All right. Anything else for the senator? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony today. We have two others who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 2204, Casey Houlihan and Scott Winkles.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm the have been working on the marijuana issues for the on behalf of the league from regulatory side since 2011 or 13-ish. I want to point out a couple of things about the tax proposal and raising it to 8%. The first is for the first time in Oregon's history that we can tell 100% of the tax increase of the taxes on local ballots passed when it came to marijuana, and the lowest margin of victory was 64% and change. There was no gray area from the voters' perspective. So there's clearly a tolerance from the electorate for a local marijuana tax. I'd also like to point out that we're simply keeping the tax at a level that is equal to the early sales number. Now, my numbers are Washington has some sales tax numbers and it's a little bit different, but you're about a 37% tax rate at point of sale in the state of Washington. They made some changes. They had a very odd tax rate where it was taxed at each level of the exchange. That was like half the price was going towards the tax. That was clearly an error. So they've made some changes. And Colorado and Denver, with the Denver special sales tax, it's the price. It's about 30.43% in terms of local tax. So Oregon's still going to be much lower. The incentives for illicit sales for someone who is willing to engage in that activity are going to remain, and here's why. The mid-quality price, and I'm getting this off of a website, it's not due to any personal sampling, but the mid-quality price of the product in Oregon is about $180. In Georgia, it's $231. So there's and a tremendous amount of the product that's grown in Oregon is being exported to that region of the country. Oregon is, how to put this, in the same way you can get larger hazelnuts in the Willamette Valley, in Representative Marsh's district, they can grow marijuana products in plants that produce what I'm told is a higher quality and certainly at a greater quantity. And so we had some testimony, there was some testimony in the Joint Committee indicating that our supply just in the medical side was sufficient to meet the demands for the entire Western, all the Western states medical markets except for California. And I believe someone else had indicated that it was 3 to 5 times greater than Oregon's capacity to consume, we hope. So that's the those are the other the cost drivers, and there are costs associated for local governments. One of the things we hear from the industry is that they are still being forced to compete with the illicit market, illicit trade. The league does have a bill printed at our request to address civil enforcement that would allow us to put liens on property similar to what's done with illicit liquor sales and production to address part of that. That's going to take resources. We have parts of the state that are disparately impacted. Southern Oregon, Grants Pass area, they have a tremendous amount number of illicit, still remaining illicit grows for export. There is an expectation on the part of the citizenry and a part of the industry that those be dealt with, and that simply can't be done for free. And so we urge your support for this legislation. Additionally, I have chatted with my associate from the Association of Oregon Counties, and this will be hard to get the words out, but we have agreed that 2% of the tax locally imposed could go to the counties to address some of their concerns, as the way it's currently structured, all 8% would go to a city if the shop is located within the city, but the counties wouldn't receive any resources. And so we have been in negotiations with AOC and would agree to that change.
I understand why that might be difficult to say.
It was hard.
Mr. Houlihan, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Casey Houlihan. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association. We're a statewide trade association currently representing over 120 retail businesses throughout the state of Oregon. Our members are predominantly cannabis retailers as well as folks making retail cannabis products, including edibles manufacturers, extractors, ancillary businesses trying to connect to people in the retail cannabis space. We're here today in opposition of House Bill 2204, precisely because of a lot of the concerns that Senator Przanski brought up earlier in his testimony. I wanted to just dovetail from some of his comments and reiterate our concerns about the availability of a lot of these products through the illicit marketplace. As many of you are probably aware, a lot of these products are currently available on Craigslist, Instagram, Facebook, private groups. Social media is a very common proliferator of a lot of these illicit materials, as well as through traditional social networks. It's fair to say that cannabis consumers historically, prior to legalization, had already been purchasing a lot of these products through, let's say, the informal marketplace, and a lot of them are not terribly concerned about returning, or at least that's what several of our members are hearing as they see their average tickets for customers decline, and there are a number of people coming in a day decline as well. We're already seeing a reapportionment in 2203 for additional tax revenue to be going towards the cities and the counties. We're not sure at this point, especially during the industry's nascency, that an additional increase like that will lead to an increase in that revenue. And in fact, we included in our testimony, which we submitted beforehand, an economic analysis done from Whitney Economics, who's one of the more knowledgeable members of the industry putting together some of these estimates, and he's showing that in 2016, somewhere near 40% of the in-state domestic consumption was still purchased through the illicit marketplace. And if that's so, 2017, with additional costs and additional regulatory hurdles, we may see that illicit market share increase, and in so doing, we may also see a decrease in the state's net revenue, certainly if more of it is going to be allocated towards the county. So that's the basis of many of our concerns. We would like to reduce access to many of these secondary markets, but we feel that in order to do so, we need a period of time where the legal marketplace can become competitive to the illegal marketplace. And that's something that we think that this bill would ultimately, this bill, we believe, would make these products more available on the illicit market, more inexpensive on the illicit market, more attractive for consumers to purchase on the illicit market, and we'd like to change that trend because we feel that including more of the state's cannabis market share in the legal market will lead to a larger increase in the revenues. With that, I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made a comment that you would like, that the intent is for the legal marketplace to become more competitive, assuming that the tax stays at 17 plus 3 and we don't allow it to go beyond that. You're still going to be carrying that 20% overhead. So what's the plan for making it more competitive?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh. We believe that the innovation that the market is currently seeing, and certainly evident from the diversity of products and the range of products available to consumers these days, is doing quite a bit to lead consumers into this legal marketplace. However, what we're trying to do is prevent any additional incentives from people to divert their consumer choice into an illegal marketplace rather than through the legal supply channels. There are additional regulatory hurdles that will make these legal products more costly, but that does also come with the additional public safety benefits, packaging, labeling, testing, that we obviously wanted to see from Measure 91 in the first place. So,
Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as the market matures, one would think that the price of the product would drop, and the regulatory portion would thus be still a problem, but maybe not as big a one. That's the thing we've seen in other somewhat similar industries like alcohol, beer, that thing. So at what point do you anticipate that the market will mature to a point where we see that kind of reduction in cost? So I understood that there's some sort of a hang-up now in the processing, whatever our rules are here, but I anticipate that will go away. So I'm just wondering, because isn't the greatest way of doing away with the black market driving down the price of the legal market? And so I'm just asking, at what point are we going to start seeing not the tax part decline, but the actual cost of the product?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, that's a perfectly valid question, and I think that we don't know exactly when that tipping point will come where we'll start seeing the returns on that, but I do think that as we proceed, and as you mentioned, the Joint Committee on this is examining some of the other overregulation areas where they can reduce some of the costs of these products and getting to market. I know that certainly on the testing side there are a lot of changes that are being examined right now by certain work groups to try to streamline some of those processes and reduce those costs. But as a realistic matter, we're not going to see the complete results of those efforts until, I would think, sometime later this year. And we still haven't even gotten through a full biennium to distribute the funds collected from cannabis sales tax yet. So I would think that it's going to take years before we're able to completely extinguish this illicit market share that's accounting for, by some estimates, $250 million a year in the state. And to Representative Barnhart's earlier point, it's important to keep in mind that there's a distinction to be made between the in-state illicit market and the out-of-state export illicit market. And I'm inclined to bet from our conversations with members that most of the people in Josephine County that the folks testifying here yesterday had some issues with locally are not the people that are in Eugene or Salem or Portland accounting for this massive share of the illicit market. The export market in Southern Oregon is distinct from the domestic sales market illicitly in the Willamette Valley.
Right. Well, the issue is regulation versus competition, or law enforcement versus competition, and competition suggests it works better, just saying, because we just don't have enough people to run around doing all the enforcement. So ultimately, it seems to me the solution is going to be driving down the price of that which is being sold legally, and as opposed to driving down whatever the tax or regulation I get, tax I get, but there's still a lot of space in there. I'm just guessing, as a percentage of the total price of a product, how much currently is tax and how much currently is not? Is it just 10% of the total price of the product, 50%? Where is it?
Well, the tax is added separately from the cost
of
the product.
Yes, but as a total cost of the product, how much is the tax amounting to? If the product was to be $10 with no tax, and then you add the tax on, and it's $1. That would be you're adding 10% to the price. Which is it right now on the legal market?
On the legal market, they're adding the additional 20% in all the localities that have added the 17 and the 3. It's unclear at this point what percentage of that 10 is added from regulatory costs or just market competition. I would think that one of the additional things to consider is the first year we saw the OLCC experience quite a logjam of licensing and applications. And we do know, and this is certainly consistent with my experiences from the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference last November, but there's quite a few growers in the southern portion of the state that have not completed their entryway into our legal production regime yet. And I think that ultimately the way to reduce those costs is to increase the market size of people that are producing inside the legal regime. By driving up supply and increasing diversity of supply, we will drive prices down. We've seen that over time.
Thank you. That was the answer.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we're going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2203 and 2204. I'm trying to manage the rest of our work. We have a public hearing scheduled, and several people want to be heard on 2156 and 2157. They're both relating to telephone numbers, and I think that's reasonable to open them together, don't you, Representative Smith?
Most definitely, sir.
Fine, thank you. We'll open the public hearings on House Bill 2156 and 2157. I think Representative Smith wants to be heard first, and we'll hear from him. Just a moment. We have staff is going to give us a brief introduction of the two bills. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bills 2156 and 2157 are very similar to each other. They both have subsequent referrals to the Ways and Means Committee, the Joint Ways and Means Committee. And basically, the measures would require the Department of Revenue to establish and maintain toll-free telephone numbers or in other electronic means of communication to answer representatives from businesses in 2156. And in 2157, the toll-free telephone number would be to answer certified public accountants who have questions about their Oregon tax laws. And it requires the department to monitor and provide sufficient staffing for the telephone numbers and electronic means of communication that would permit the department to answer questions or resolve issues in an expedited manner.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57 in Eastern Oregon. The two bills before you came about during the interim as I was having an opportunity to visit with a group of small business owners and a group of certified public accountants. The conversation moved to how do we create some efficiency within government, at which point a handful of certified public accountants who I highly respect suggested that we create a dedicated toll-free line, doesn't have to be toll-free, but a dedicated phone line in which certified public accountants could directly contact a peer agent within the Oregon Department of Revenue to handle and to answer questions as it relates to tax issues. Here's how they explained the problem to me. A client of a CPA firm comes into their office. They've received a letter from the Oregon Department of Revenue. The issue could easily be taken care of with a 5, 10, 15-minute phone call, but the certified public accountants are having to call into the 1-800 number, of which point then they enter a pipeline process to which answers are responded back to by mail. And as a consequence, this is creating a tremendous additional workload within the Department of Revenue. In addition, it's also making it difficult for CPAs to get answers to their questions that could be answered very, very quickly. Colleagues, I'd share with you, in addition to serving with you on the House Revenue Committee, I also serve as chair of the General Government Subcommittee on Ways and Means, and the Oregon Department of Revenue budget is within that budget authority. It's our intention in that committee to work to find the dollars to make this occur, but I would like to statutorily bring this forward as well. So that's House Bill 2157. The second one is 2156. Where we would ask the Department of Revenue to establish a telephone number in which business owners could directly contact the Department of Revenue to ask questions as it relates to correspondence they receive from the department. Again, trying to avoid getting into a pipeline process where inquiries are handled by mail. It's our belief that by approving and supporting House Bill 2156 and 2157, we'll create additional efficiencies, we'll eliminate unnecessary extensions being filed, and we'll help enhance collections and ultimately drive up revenue for the state of Oregon simply by enacting these two measures. We had asked for your support, committee members, and send it to Ways and Means.
Thank you. And the bill does have subsequent, both of them have subsequents to Ways and Means. Yep. Questions for Representative Smith? Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, colleague. First of all, I just wondered if you had any potential of conflicts of interest to declare about this bill.
Not on
I
this
I can't
line.
Resist. I can't resist. Also, I was just thinking about it, and I wondered if there was any discussion either among that group or whether you've talked to DOR about this. Of, you know, a phone is one thing, but, you know, on a lot of customer service stuff I've found is there's a place on the website where you can click and do a live chat with somebody that way. Is this something, I mean, I don't know if maybe they're already set up for, so that just might be another way. If the goal is to have better access for these particular, for the CPAs, for the businesses to DOR, that I just would argue, why just limit yourself to the 800 number necessarily if it turns out they could put together something really efficient on an with an online thing?
It's a wonderful idea. Hadn't thought about that, but now we have, and we think that's wonderful. And when if should you send this down to Ways and Means General Government, that's an idea we'll institute. I do want to share with you, Chair, that there Two letters have been drafted on this, one from the Board of Tax Practitioners, the other from the Board of Accountancy, and they've made certain suggestions to amend the bill. We're wide open to that. Should you want to do it here, that would be wonderful, or if you sent it to Ways and Means, we could do it down there.
All right. I don't know if you know the answers to these questions, but one of the possible reasons that occurs to me that the department might be responding to these kinds of inquiries in writing now is that the department then might be bound by the answers that they give.
Oh, very much so.
You wouldn't be able to do that, of course, with an informal conversation on a telephone call.
Correct.
Would you? So at that point, if it's a complex issue,
then they'll need to continue.
You still might
end
up with a need for a written response or a written communication back and forth in order to reach a conclusion about it, mightn't you?
Mr. Chair, most definitely agree with you on that. What we're trying to do is to take care of those simple little issues that can be taken care of with a simple phone call between professional to professional, peer to peer. Those more complex issues, most definitely, we're going to have to go through the natural process that already occurs.
Thank you, Representative Bass. Did I skip somebody? Representative Marsh.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a small comment. I would think the phrase "and other electronic means of communication" would encompass anything you could think of.
There you go.
In terms of communicating.
There you go. Really, Mr. Chair, just very, very briefly, where this came about is a certified public accountant who's well-respected in the Hermiston community was visiting with us, and one of his clients had received a letter in which a very, very simple five-minute conversation could have corrected a potential error on a tax return. The process ended up taking 120-plus days. Caused frustration for the, in this case, a small business owner, and actually cost the state of Oregon lost revenue at the time until they were able to make it up. And so we're just trying to create a small efficiency for state government.
Representative Vance?
Thanks, Sharon. And I really do appreciate the thought here. What I fear, of course, is the needing 50 or 60 or 100 people to answer all the questions, just because that's the nature of our systems, they're complicated. And so how one would control that is really the question. Simple stuff, easy. Hard stuff, hopeless. And so I just don't know how that's going to be controlled.
Yeah, so Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bentz, Mr. John Borden, who's legislative fiscal staff, who oversees the Oregon Department of Revenue, should you pass this bill to Ways and Means, we're going to sit down and begin having conversations between LFO, the department, and legislators to figure out what is that right number of staff. Mr. Borden sharing with me that he believes it's between 5 to 7 FTE. That would be redirected. These would be existing employees that would be redirected to this assignment.
Yes, please.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to say that I'm opposed to it. I'm just saying that I've been through this before in other situations, mostly legal, and you just can't get enough people, and then you get a lot of people mad because either they're on hold for 100 years or when they finally get there, people say, that's far too complex, go hire a lawyer, and then everybody's mad at us. For our being offered a service, which we really can't. You have to, however we do this, it would have to be really sold on the most minimalist basis.
Right.
At least that's been my experience.
What I would anticipate is when those conversations occur, we'll bring in the Board of Tax Practitioners and the Board of Accountancy and our professional folks to sit down with us and give us their input as well, along with the legislative fiscal staff on how we're going to make this work.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Let's hear from
Tom Maynard, Martin Pizzioni, Clint Bentz, please. Gentlemen. Whichever order you like.
Because he's a Democrat. Tell me first.
All right. It's because he's a
Democrat. Chair Representative Barnhart, Vice Chair Representative Bentz, and Vice Representative Smith Warner, members of the House Committee on Revenue. For the record, my name is Tom Maynard. I'm a member of the Taxation Committee and past chair of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm a certified public accountant with a practice in Beaverton called Thomas C. Maynard CPA, and I appreciate this opportunity to appear before you today. I'm here to argue on behalf of the approximately 4,500 members of the Oregon Society of CPAs, and I respectfully testify and urge you to support these two bills, both which direct the Department of Revenue to establish and maintain toll-free numbers and other electronic means of communication to answer questions from business representatives and certified public accountants. Several years ago, a writer in the Wall Street Journal had headlined his article, IRS Deputizes CPAs, or wording very similar to that. Of course, he was exercising his literary license, but the picture that the headline shows the increased necessity of dialogue between government and tax practitioners, which for today's purpose also encompasses other business representatives. During my college years, I had a summer job as a state tax auditor, and I still retain the memory, the mental pictures from one of the first days on the job when we were walking across the parking lot, and a supervisor and an auditor were having a debate or discussion about what functions have to do with the business and what functions are the responsibility of government. And I think this is a flawed discussion because it's really not an either-or discussion. In today's place, with increasing complexity of tax codes, and especially at the state level, if you talk to practitioners, that's where the real action is. There's the opportunity to detail and solve issues not only by email but also by telephone helps reduce delays and expenditures, expedite outcomes, which this is far more efficient for the taxpayer and for the Department of Revenue. On several occasions, looking to other agencies, it's been necessary for me to contact the State of Oregon Employment Department regarding notices mailed to taxpayers, and I've found them to be very responsive, and simple misunderstandings were resolved in a single telephone conversation. I've had telephone contact with other states like the State of Washington, State of Vermont, and others over time, and found them very productive for learning specific applications of their rules, avoiding any compliance infractions. The Internal Revenue Service employs its own practitioner's hotline through which, with proper authorization, a power of attorney, a tax professional can represent individuals and businesses to resolve myriad problems. By way of analogy, I recall preparing a consolidated federal income tax return of a Fortune 500 company, which suffered flood and fire losses around the country most years. And this is kind of an intangible, but it has to do with about communication on these technical things. It was necessary for me to personally visit the risk management department in the company, and it started out with a discussion of the definition of the word loss, because loss for insurance purposes is different than for accounting purposes. And in the accounting for losses for financial statements, which are prepared for investing, borrowing, and management purposes, can be different than what the accounting is for income tax purposes, which is performed for administrative purposes, that is, the payment and collection of taxes. In summary, even though we aren't really deputized, there exists a codependency between practitioners and businesses in the Oregon Department of Revenue. The Oregon Department of Revenue's new Revenue Online Assistance and tax professional and practitioners assistance is beginning to prove very beneficial. Yet online access isn't enough. The relationship will be much healthier with a reliable availability of one-to-one telephone conversations. And by dialogue, I don't mean leaving a message on an 800 line. I mean talking back and forth. This is true both for tax professionals as well as officers and employees representing a business. For these reasons, I respectfully request a passage of HB 2156 and 2157, and I thank you for the opportunity to share my experiences and concern that I feel for these two, that these two bills do address, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Let's go through the rest of the panel, and then we'll see what the questions there are. Okay.
Chair Barnhart, co-chairs Bentz and Smith-Warner. My name is Clint Bentz, and I'm here also on behalf of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm a practitioner with a local accounting firm, Bolt Carlisle Smith, with offices here in Salem, Staten, and Albany. I'm here today also to speak in favor of House Bill 2156 and 2157. These bills require the department to establish, maintain the toll-free numbers we've talked about, other electronic means of communication, where businesses can reach out and CPAs can reach out to staff at the Oregon Department of Revenue to ask questions and resolve issues in an expedited fashion. The Department of Revenue has worked really hard to be responsive to the community, and both the business community and the tax practitioner community. We appreciate those efforts. They used to have a tax practitioner hotline, which from my understanding is they're looking at reinstating, which so we have not had this capacity to actually talk to people in the department directly for a while. But even when that gets established, you know, adding 800 access, because most CPAs and most businesses in Oregon are not local to Salem. So, you know, having that ability to call, because individuals can call around the state toll-free, but businesses and practitioners cannot. So that helps. You know, we all rely on the ability for individuals and businesses to voluntarily comply with the tax code. You know, if we had to have auditors and policemen standing on the corner and visiting everybody to make sure they complied, it would be a mess. So we rely on people's voluntary compliance with the tax code, and we're there to, as practitioners, to help them comply with the tax code in the best way that we can. But as businesses grow increasingly complex and the tax code tries to keep up, it's important to have access to people inside the department so that we can that have the necessary training and expertise to answer these questions when they come up and resolve problems before they become real problems. These two bills direct the department to monitor and provide staffing necessary to answer these questions, resolve issues in an expedited manner. I don't know that necessarily means having a team of people sitting around waiting for the phone to ring, but some sort of a triage where somebody is picking up the phone and saying, okay, what's the issue, and getting it then to the people inside the department that can actually answer the question. It also directs the department to monitor this, and I think this is critical legislative guidance to the department.
Excuse me.
And it's going to help ensure that businesses and tax practitioners receive the assistance they need to comply timely with the tax code. I think especially during tax season when we're all under pretty strict filing deadlines, this ability to answer questions that our clients are bringing us, especially when the law changes, and we have things that come up and it's just not working. We have situations right now this year where we're having conversations between the department and the software providers and our clients to try to fix issues when it just didn't roll out right. And so having the ability to have those conversations fixes problems for lots of taxpayers. So hopefully, you know, something I'd like to see added is the ability to securely upload documents and electronically share confidential client information rather than having to send things back and forth on a fax machine or in the mail. So, I mean, there's lots of ways that this can be improved. And having legislative, legislative guidance to the department to do this, I think, well, I don't know that it's necessary. It'd be nice. It'd be helpful. So I encourage you to support these two common sense bills. Happy to answer questions you might have regarding them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martin Pitioni. I'm the executive director for the Board of Accountancy. And I want to just very briefly summarize the written testimony that you have before you in the record. And in essence, for the board, our testimony is from a neutral position, and it's focused on a specific small language issue in House Bill 2157, which, as drafted, would actually not capture the full scope of the professionals that are authorized to practice before DOR. And so we wanted to bring that to the attention of the committee, and we're essentially suggesting a friendly amendment that essentially by adding either specific statutory references to capture the remaining folks that would be out there or having more generic language that would basically simply say that those authorized to practice before DOR would be covered by this service. You wouldn't get into putting DOR in a position of saying you have to be licensed under this provision. That's the 673040 that shows up in the bill. So quickly, what that refers to is there are some CPAs that have practice privileges in Oregon that are under different statute because they have an out-of-state license, but they're licensed to practice here. That's called the mobility statutes. There are public accountants that are under different statutory reference. And then I think you'll have testimony here in a little while from some the Board of Tax Practitioners, who will essentially also request that their practitioners be included. So that's essentially the only issue why we're here, to just to put that on the committee's radar so that can move through the process, maybe as a friendly amendment. And I take from the comments of the representative, distinguished Representative Smith, who testified first, that he's okay with essentially making those adjustments.
And he's not in the room right at the moment, so we may have to... Oh, there he is. The not quite stated question for you was, do you agree with Mr. Pizzioni's recommended amendments to the bill as contained in his written testimony?
Almost definitely.
Yeah.
No problem with that.
Any questions for the panel? One idea that we just heard, that there be a secure method for transmission of documents, of course, is easily done over the Internet if you use an encrypted connection, and it's just simply a question of setting it up. Very good. Without any more questions, we thank this panel very much for your testimony, and we'll call for Howard, is it Moyes, and Jody Weiser, please. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill? Yes, the department would like to be heard as well. I wondered if you might.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. And I think this is a pretty brilliant idea, except for one thing. It asks for a shift from business expense to public expense, the waiting online to talk, waiting to talk to somebody. And so I think that and it's also kind of elitist, because it's saying, well, if you own a business or you're a CPA, you should have a special line. But if you're just somebody working two jobs, you'll have to go through, you know, and just wait. So I think what we should do is figure out how much it would cost to do this and have a dedicated line that you can pay to get expedited service. We could even use it as a money-making project. I think that, I mean, I know that my CPA has called the department to find out how to treat tax credits. I paid for him to do that, right? If we could do it faster, I don't care whether I'm paying the department or him. And so it seems to me if we just have a charge on that call, it works. But if you're saying we're going to find 5 to 7 people to do this rather than teach school, yeah, I don't think that works. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from Howard next, and then the department may want to comment on the whole thing.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Howard Moyes. I'm the executive director for the Board of Tax Practitioners, and my comments basically echo those of Martin Pizzioni from the Board of Accountancy. Representative Smith, our understanding of the intent of the bill is that representatives of small businesses with tax issues can contact the department. There are roughly 3,500 licensed tax practitioners in Oregon right now. They represent mainly the small and medium-sized businesses, and the current language of the bill would exclude them. And again, to just echo what Martin mentioned, either we would recommend either broadening the language so that anybody licensed in Oregon would be included, or perhaps just add the statutory designation for our licensees.
Thank you. Now, any questions for these two, Representative Smith?
No, Mr. Chair. I do just want to put on the record, I fully support what you're sharing there, that both those letters that came in, we fully support those amending the bill to include that.
Okay. Any others? All right, stay right there, because there may be some others later. From the department,
right.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And we just wanted to explain some of the things that we do to help with the practitioner community, business community. We do, we did have a practitioner hotline up until a few years ago, and it wasn't being used as well as we had hoped, and so we stopped providing that number. We did provide the number again as of January of this year, so we do have a practitioner hotline. It is not a toll-free number, but it is 503-947-3541 if practitioners want to use it to call and get help. It is not manned. It is a voicemail box, so we can triage the call and determine whether it goes to our estate tax unit or our corporate tax unit or our 911 tax unit or our personal income tax unit. So we did just reinstate that phone line at the request of the CPA communities and Representative Smith meeting with our director. We also have 16 tax help email boxes where people can send their questions directly to the program that they know in which they have an issue or a question. We provide them in all our training materials as well. So they go out directly to a program staff analyst that would be able to answer those questions for them. And they can certainly always ask for a telephone call if they'd like to. We also echo the comments from the Board of Accountancy and the Board of Tax Practitioners about the number of tax practitioners that are allowed to use this line. In practicality, there's no way we could exclude other practitioners like tax attorneys or enrolled agents. They've already mentioned the LTCs and LTPs. Our partner agencies came to us with some pretty dramatic concerns about this particular bill in the fact that it would require the Department of Revenue to answer questions about all Oregon tax laws. And I don't think you guys really mean for us to answer questions about like fuel taxes or unemployment taxes that are administered by other agencies. So we would like a friendly amendment to clarify what Oregon tax laws you'd like us to answer. We do have more than just income tax laws. We have tobacco tax laws. We have 911 taxes, estate taxes, that kind of thing. So maybe application of Oregon tax laws that are administered by the department would be helpful, or if you really only want to narrow it to personal and corporate taxpayers, then say income tax programs. And with that, the other thing I heard in testimony I wanted to make sure that was clear is that now with our new computer system, we have a web-based portal called Revenue Online. Mm. Practitioners and taxpayers can securely upload documents directly to the department. And so I know that was a comment there, but that is something that's been available with each rollout of our core system replacement as it's moved along. So with that, if you have any questions.
Yes, Representative Bueller.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Can you give me an idea what your target performance metrics are for responding to email and telephone inquiries?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, we try to get back to folks by the next business day.
And how successful are you on doing so?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, we just reinstated it this last month, so I don't know what the metrics are yet, but I do believe that they're answering the calls promptly. And I know that we respond to emails promptly as well.
Follow up. Yeah, I'd like to see what your performance is after 90 days in terms of response. Because I've been getting lots of complaints recently from constituents about their tax returns, especially refunds, being pushed out months and months and months right now. Can you comment with regards
Mr.
to
Chair,
the problems you're having?
Yeah,
refunds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, you may be aware that the IRS and many states have been dealing with fraud on refunds. And one of the things that they've done, and I think you just heard testimony from the CPAs yesterday about the, or maybe earlier, I don't know what day it is anymore, but about the change from refunds being issued until February 15th. That was one of the things that they testified to, and that's we tied to that as well. So for this tax year, we just started issuing refunds for taxpayers February 15th, which means that it goes through some cycles before people will get their refunds. If they're large refunds, we have controls in place to prevent large refunds year over year from being sent out. So sometimes taxpayers haven't provided information that we've asked them to provide, and that causes some delays, or they haven't prepared the return correctly, and that may cause some delays. But we do have a standard that we try and get refunds issued as soon as possible after the return is received. And interest begins to accrue after 45 days after the due date, so generally around June 1st, the end of May, beginning of June, if we haven't issued a refund by then, the taxpayer then gets interest paid on that refund. So there's a recognition that it takes us some time to process refunds, process returns, and issue a refund. And there's even a little bit of more of a buffer for when there's issues with refunds. This year, we haven't even started really issuing them yet, though. We have a bulk of them that are going to be going out, I believe. I got an email last week that said that they're going to be going out in phases starting this week.
I would note, we heard, those of us who attended the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee this meeting this morning, heard about that issue indirectly from the state economist, who was concerned about the statistics he had available because the returns were not hadn't been finished processing. And I'm aware that the Internal Revenue Service is concerned about identity theft and about fraud having to do with refundable tax credits primarily. And I assume that that's an issue that also affects your department.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It affects, it's a national issue. And one of the things that the IRS changed that is caught part of causing the delay is that they've allowed or required employers and payers of information returns like W-2s and 1099s. They need to be filed by January 31st of each year. And that gives us a couple of weeks to upload that information and get it ready so that when we process returns, we're able to match it in real time rather than waiting after the fact and doing it. So it's to prevent fraudulent activity up front. And this is our first year of actually having that accelerated data and not something that's at the back end. So this is the first year we've been able to do that.
Are any of those documents sent to you electronically?
From the
W-2s, for example?
Mr. Chair, and yes, they are sent to us electronically.
So you can do the match. The computer can do the match, yes, without your intervention directly.
Correct.
All right. Other questions for this panel? It does sound to me as though you're already doing some of the things this bill contemplates.
Mr. Chair, we are. The only thing we aren't doing is the 800 number, and we don't have a manned line. We don't have a live person answering it and triaging the call. We have a voicemail box doing that. But again, there was a period of time where we didn't do that. We didn't offer it for a few years, and we've just reinstated it. So I think that if we give it a chance, it might work. But it isn't an 800 number,
right,
and it isn't manned.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of the reason that the department has reinstituted this was after conversations we had, after visiting with the LFO, they thought it would be a good idea for us to statutorily have this conversation.
Yeah.
And so that's the reason the bills are continuing.
Well, if I were the department and I'd heard from the chair of the subcommittee that we might be considering a budgetary item to help pay for it, I think I'd be interested too, for whatever that's worth. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. And with that, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2156 and 2157 and open a work session on House Bill 2280. Kyle, those are yours. Would you remind us what this bill is about?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the four bills you actually have up for work session are all Department of Revenue bills. House Bill 2280 was repealing ORS 308-325, which was a requirement that any person could demand the assessor an official certificate of the fact of their assessed property, and if they didn't receive that, they could fine. There'd be a fine of $100, so that's removing that statute from law.
Thank you. Essentially an obsolete provision, given that we have other ways of doing the same, dealing with the same issue.
Exactly, Mr. Chair, yes. And we do have the paperwork. There's no fiscal or revenue impact from the change.
Thank you. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2280 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2280 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Bill goes to the floor. Representative Bueller, will you carry?
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Bueller will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2280. Open a work session on House Bill 2281. That's also yours, Kyle, I think.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2281, just a quick refresher on this again. It was the timing of the disqualification of designated western or eastern forest land that's discovered by the county assessor is no longer being used as forest land. The department testified to this again. This is another of DOR's bills, and it doesn't change the requirement of when the assessor have to send the notice, so that would still be August 15th. It really is aligning the tax year or the tax assessment year with the tax year, which are two different years. So it has no fiscal, no revenue impact as well.
Thank you. Representative Bentz?
Chair, I move House Bill 2281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Representative Marsh, will you carry this bill?
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Marsh will carry. That will close the work session on House Bill 2281 and open a work session on House Bill 2277. Kyle, is that also yours?
Yes, I have the next two, actually, as well.
Yep.
2277 essentially is instituting more or less an offset program for the property tax program. So prior to a refund being going out for a property tax refund that's owed, if there's tax liability for that property owner for the existing property or a different property, it would go to pay that first prior to the refund going back to the property owner. There's no fiscal impact. The revenue impact is minimal, as it would be expected in the pretty rare occasion of where there is liability owed and a refund's about to go out and the property owner wouldn't otherwise pay that property tax liability. This would make a payment for that. So there could be a very minimal increase in revenue, but it wouldn't change the underlying tax liability. It's just more of an increase in collections.
It's simply a compliance issue, isn't it?
Yes. Exactly.
Right. I mean, the tax is still due either way. One presumes it reduces compliance costs as well, perhaps.
Again, Mr.
The cost of collection.
It's pretty rare that this would be expected to be used. It probably not a whole lot of instances where this will actually change revenue collections.
Thank you. Representative Bentz?
I'm Chairman of House Bill 2277 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2277 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Representative Smith, will you carry this bill?
I would.
Thank you. Representative Smith will carry House Bill 2277.
Good effort.
And we will close the work session on House Bill 2277 and open a work session on House Bill 2278. Kyle?
Okay. House Bill 2278, we do have the -1 amendment, and that's what we have the paperwork for.
Okay.
And this is the fourth of the DOR's bills. There is one more that will be discussed on Monday. But it was making changes. It's relating to local budget law. So there's a few changes in there. No longer requiring historic ghost towns to comply with local budget law. Community college appropriations for their budgeting would be separated by organizational unit, which just ties things up with how they budget. And then it was also the changing in instances where local governments pass a bond at the May election. It gives them a little bit more time to send the paperwork to the assessor to actually impose that tax. As just a reminder, and there's discussion in this committee about this when the bill was at the public hearing, it is required that the debt would be incurred. So the bonds have to be sold first prior to the local government being able to send more or less the paperwork to the assessor to then impose the tax.
And this bill changes that or does not change that?
It wouldn't change. No, it does not change that. It does not change the requirement for the debt to be incurred. It just changes the timing more or less from 6:30, June 30th to September 15th. So it gives a little more time for local government to fulfill that.
To actually incur the obligation to pay back bonds by selling them.
Yes, exactly. That the testimony was it by June 30th was not always enough time for that to actually occur. So it gives them a little more time to sell those bonds.
Thank you.
And again, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
We might occasionally pay off a bond a little earlier, though, mightn't we?
If they were missing the deadline, it started a year later, something to that effect, yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Thank you. Representative Bentz, the -1?
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to HB 2278, and I was just checking to see is there a date on it? Yes, date of 2317.
2317, yes. Representative Bentz moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2278 dated February 3rd, 2017. Is there a discussion on the motion to amend the bill? Representative Bentz.
Just because.
Let's make sure. Yeah.
Yes, make sure. I just
let's
want
do.
To be, yeah, just Kyle could perhaps explain the what the language on, lines 24, 28.
On page 2?
On page 2.
Yeah, the bold-faced language on the amendment. He's asking about.
So this is the you said 24 to 28 on page 2 of the dash 1?
Yes. Yeah, I think you're looking. Yeah, this, yeah, that's right there. Yeah.
That's on my budget. Yeah, so this was a change, and I believe this, if I'm remembering the testimony right, came at the behest of the local governments to the Department of Revenue to make this change, which would allow the supplemental budget.
Go back to page 1, line 9.
Allowing to add a supplemental budget if, let's see, if it did not include the general obligation bonds passed in the May election. So in meeting the, when they put the budget together, they may not know whether or not the general obligation bonds will actually pass in the May election. And so I believe the change there would be allowing them to
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Now we've got it.
I've got it.
Okay. That was a piece that was left out of the original bill, apparently. Mm.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that I believe the testimony was that DOR was continuing to receive feedback as this was still working through, and that was one of the changes suggested.
All right. Any other discussion on the motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendment is adopted. Representative Benz?
Chair, I move House Bill 2278 as amended to throw out the due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2278 as amended.
Representative Benz.
Representative Benz, what did I say?
Smith.
Representative Benz. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2278 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion? All right. With that, the motion is adopted. Representative Hernandez, will you carry the bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Hernandez will carry. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2278. Paul, do we have any announcements before we adjourn? Oh, we have a work session on a bill introduction. We'll open a work session for bill introduction. Representative Smith Warner, it's right behind your computer.
But there's no numbers.
There he is.
Oh, sorry,
actually.
There are. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. LC 2974, dated 11-29-16.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner moves that LC 2974 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Representative Vance.
Mr. Chair, as we discussed previously, because we couldn't determine who to attribute the bill to, I will be a no.
Thank you. I would note first, that the agreeing to this motion does not suggest that a member agrees with the bill, approves of the idea of it at all. It's simply a way of getting the bill before the legislature. It's a practice instituted by Representative Lane Shetterly when he was chair of this committee, I think, in 2003. It may have been as long ago as 2001, lost in the mists of time, as far as I understand. I will simply note that as I look at this bill, it deals with an issue that, LC, it deals with an issue that we have discussed in past sessions having to do with the stranded tax credits of government agencies that were unable to sell them because the value of them as determined by the department was higher than any possible transferee was willing to pay, and this would allow for a change. And I'm not certain that this actually accomplishes the correct result, but it does get the issue before the legislature. And I have to tell you, I don't know exactly where this came from. It may have been something that I had drafted, but I simply don't remember. With that, is there any other discussion? Representative Buehler.
Yeah, Chair, I'll also be voting no. I think this practice of committee bills puts a risk of a lack of accountability and transparency to our processes. My understanding of the concept and use of committee bills in the past was technical fixes, and I think we certainly have seen over the last few years that the concept has been expanded mightily to incorporate lots of other efforts at legislation.
Thank you. Other discussion? I would simply note, there is other discussion.
Representative
Johnson?
I'll just be a no also, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Some
Representative Smith Warner.
I would just like to say that I will be a yes, and I think that this the introduction of committee bills plays a very useful role in the legislative process. I think there's plenty of ideas that are had from all across the spectrum that it is useful to throw some spaghetti at the wall
to see what ends up sticking, because we may end up with something that I might want not be sure about, and getting it introduced and having it as part of the conversation is important. I believe that this entire process is extremely transparent. Everything we do with every bill that comes before us, we all vote on it publicly, we debate it publicly. I find it a very useful way to interject some the legislative version of brainstorming by doing this. So I will continue to be a yes on this and future committee introductions.
Thank you. And let me simply add to that, which I completely agree with Representative Smith Warner's characterization. I would simply add to that the initial email that I remember receiving from Representative Shetterly simply indicated that bills that were related to revenue issues could be introduced by the committee without regard to their whether the Representative Shetterly agreed with the content or not, as a convenience. I actually offered to the committee a large number of bills that were very substantive in content, did not happen to conform to the current understanding of the majority of the legislature at that time, and promptly disappeared from view. But they were introduced by the committee. Interestingly, this bill is one of those where, without actually having a hearing and discussing the issue and understanding the issue, I think it's unclear whether anybody would support it or not. And so actually attaching a name to the bill might be doing a disservice to a person who simply wanted to raise the inquiry about it. And I think that's a very useful purpose for this kind of process. We also have, to expand on the metaphor of spaghetti sticking to the wall, we also have those situations in which a bill is a very unpopular idea when it's first introduced, but two or three sessions later, after we've had a chance to get used to it, it becomes one that is approved and becomes valuable to the state. Any other discussion? We better call the roll on the motion to introduce LC 2974.
Representative Mueller.
No.
Representative Hernandez.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Marsh.
Yes.
Representative Nose.
Yes.
Representative Smith.
No.
Vice Chair Smith Warner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz.
No.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Motion having received the required majority is adopted, and the bill will be introduced. And we will close the work session on bill introduction. Is there any other business to come before the committee today? Our next meeting is tomorrow at 1 o'clock. See you all then. Committee is adjourned.